Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
There is outrage from ex-soldiers after news a $200 million program for mental health services for our vets will be handed out over decades and not the next 6 years, which was originally reported. We're joined by a veterans advocate who says they were misled and deceived.
This week, one of the two new Democrat MPs involved in the misconduct controversy on the Hill came forward with details of what she says was sex without explicit consent. It's been just shy of a month since the allegations were made public, and NDP MP Megan Leslie speaks about what's changed on the Hill since.
Canada has a new Supreme Court judge. The Prime Minister has appointed a seasoned Quebec lawyer to the bench, but there are concerns about changes to the selection process. Liberal MP Erwin Kotler gives us his thoughts.
We discuss global security in a one-on-one with U.S. Senator and former presidential candidate John McCain, and the McLean's panel weighs in on financial transparency for First Nations.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
The complexities of mental health are changing and evolving, and so too must our response.
That's Veterans Affairs Minister Julian Fantino last Sunday announcing a $200 million investment in veterans' mental health services. It was an announcement that came just before an Auditor General's report that criticized the government for the barriers veterans face when they try to seek help for mental health issues like post-traumatic stress disorder. Auditor General Michael Ferguson says there are many reasons veterans are waiting up to 8 months or more just to hear if their application has been approved.
A complex application process, delays in obtaining medical and service records from National Defence and the Canadian Armed Forces, and long wait times for getting access to qualified healthcare professionals.
While the government faced criticism for the scathing report, by week's end the focus was back on the announcement that should have muted a lot of this negative press. Initially, it was believed that the $200 million to improve veteran services was going to be handed out over the next 6 years. But days later, we find out only $19 million will be in those first years. The rest will be spread out through the life cycle of the program, which could take 50 years.
A spokesperson for Veterans Affairs Minister Julian Fantino sent us a statement saying this money is about ensuring veterans receive compensation and support for today and the rest of their lives. They want to make sure that veterans are assured of funding for mental health services well into the future. We requested an interview with Minister Fantino, but were told he is not available. Instead, we're joined by Michael Blaise, who served with the Royal Canadian Regiment and took part in the UN peacekeeping mission in Cyprus. Blaise is now the president of Canadian Veterans Advocacy. What's your reaction after hearing that this is not just up front in the first 6 years?
Well, I think like many veterans, I feel that I've been misled and deceived. This is not the first time. You know, this government came out a couple years back, promised $2 billion, a major headline, and then it was cost-affected, we found out later, over the course of 50 years. Now they've done it again. They've come out, you know, trying to preempt the Auditor General's report, trying to deflect criticism for returning $1.13 billion to the Treasury. And now we find out that the announcement they made is not over 6 years. It's over potentially 50 years. It could be decades. And that $30 million per year over the 6 years looks very small now and insignificant compared to what the spirit of that announcement was.
And what does this mean for veterans?
Well, first of all, it's a positive thing that these clinics are being created and the satellite offices. These are important and needed facets. But, you know, we have to have them costed out and transparency when we're doing this. And veterans, you know, we're very suspicious of Minister Fantino. We're very suspicious of Prime Minister Harper and the motives. And this gives us good cause and substantiates our suspicion. Because, you know, they'll come out and promise us things with big numbers, and then we find out, you know, when $200 million is spread over the course of 50 years, it clearly does not reflect the need.
When you initially heard this announcement, you thought it was going to be around $40 million for each year. Do you think that these programs can do what's needed to be done in terms of mental health services for veterans on much less than $40 million per year?
No, I do not believe that, particularly as we fight the stigma and more veterans and their families coming forward seeking help as a consequence of the mental wounds these men and women have experienced. You know, these are good ideas, but they must be resourced appropriately. And right now, I don't see that.
What is the need for it? Do you have a figure? Can you say how much is needed to fund these programs?
Well, that's difficult to say, Cormac, in the sense that the department's not exactly forthcoming with numbers. We don't really know how many people, other than what the Auditor General reported, that have come forward. But we do know that many have been denied. We do know that many have had taken so long to go through an appeal process just to simply find justice, to be treated with the respect they deserve. There are many, many more who just give up. They're so frustrated with the system, they just throw the paperwork in the garbage and move on with their lives. This is not acceptable. The department has to be proactive, particularly on mental wounds. We fight against the stigma. You know, we have programs in the Department of National Defense that are combating stigma, and yet when these young men and women come forward, they're confronted with an adversarial process that is conducted by a minister who clearly does not care much for veterans.
So what do you want to say to the minister?
Well, I would have a minister or a message for the prime minister. And that message would be, put a minister in the Veterans Affairs portfolio that can perform the job and earn the trust of veterans. Minister Fantino has created a toxic environment. He has created a great level of distrust that is festering within the veterans community. We deserve compassion. We deserve understanding. We deserve funding based on need. And when the needs come forward, it's Minister Fantino's obligation to ensure that the resources and the funding that are required are put in place, not returning $1.13 billion on the excuse that he couldn't spend it. We know there are veterans in need in this nation, and it's his responsibility to ensure that that need is met.
So what now? Where do we go from here to try and fix some of the issues that you've brought up here in this interview in terms of funding for mental health services for veterans?
We fight. We fight. We keep fighting for funding. This government only responds to the words of those who fight for what they believe in. And right now, you know, we have veterans that are underdogs, disenfranchised, being ignored, and it's time for this nation to rally around them. This is what Canada is. We have always rallied around the downtrodden, those who have not been treated with respect, those who have been ignored and marginalized. And it's time for this nation to realize this government has put veterans in this position, despite the fact that over 152 men have died on their watch and thousands have been wounded. It's time for the nation to rally behind the wounded. It's time for the nation to speak out.
That was Michael Blaze with Canadian Veterans Advocacy.
In addition to the criticism over the $200 million mental health program, the opposition is angry that they won't have the chance to get any answers about it at committee. Liberal critic Frank Valeriot tells us the Veterans Affairs Committee was supposed to hear from department officials, but he claims the Conservatives used their majority to cancel the meeting.
Well, it's taken us a couple of weeks to try and determine who exactly was going to come before the committee to review the estimates. We'd hoped that it would be Mr. Fantino, the minister, but now he's missing in action and refuses to come, refuses to even be in Canada to be accountable to the Canadian public on the issues that are ailing our veterans. The other day, the parliamentary secretary wasn't there, which was another excuse not to proceed with our discussions about estimates. And even at that point in time, we agreed that while it was delayed, we would see people from the ministry come before us and question them on the estimates next Wednesday. And as soon as we find out that there are other issues that are arising for which the government did not want to be held accountable, including the truthfulness around this $200 million announcement and how misleading it was, everything gets canceled next week. The point here is that they're claiming that, well, we wouldn't be able to hear them in time and question them in time in order to report to Parliament within the rules of the House. The fact is that whether we report to Parliament or not, Canadians through their members of Parliament ought to have the opportunity to question the bureaucrats about how this money is being spent and why and talk about the Auditor General's report, and we're not even being given that opportunity now.
On November 19th, Veteran Affairs Minister Julian Fantino was officially invited to appear as a witness at committee. At the time we recorded this, his office wouldn't say if he will attend.
Still to come on the show, new details on the allegations made against two suspended Liberal MPs, the Supreme Court has a new judge, and we're joined by former presidential candidate, U.S. Senator John McCain. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the Supreme Court has a new judge, although there are concerns about some of the changes to the selection process. U.S. Senator John McCain speaks about global security, and the McLean's panel discusses First Nations financial transparency. But first,
one of the two NDP MPs involved in the allegations that led to the suspension of two Liberal MPs is speaking out. She has asked for anonymity but claims she had sex with Liberal Massimo Pichetti without explicit consent. She told several news outlets that it happened after a sporting event, when Pichetti invited her back to the hotel room he stays in when he is in Ottawa. She claims he sat on the bed and she froze after he first grabbed her. The New Democrat adds she wanted to leave. She also says she provided Pichetti with a condom and told the Globe and Mail she didn't say yes or no to his advances.
In a statement, Mr. Pichetti's office says he's innocent of any accusations of misconduct, and he's troubled that the unnamed complainant has chosen to air the allegations in the media. He once again calls for a third-party process to deal with this, and the New Democrat MP has signaled she's open to that as long as it remains confidential. Meanwhile, the Canadian press cite sources who say the allegations against Liberal Scott Andrews are that he made an advance on an NDP MP, but was quickly rebuffed. Both Liberal MPs deny the allegations against them. The unproven accusations have not been brought to police. There is no criminal investigation, and the two women involved do not plan to file formal complaints.
It has been nearly a month since this became public when the two Grid MPs were suspended by Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. I spoke with NDP Deputy Leader Megan Leslie about how MPs are dealing with the controversy and the larger discussion of the culture on Parliament Hill. So Megan, it's been a month now since the sort of dramatic announcement, I guess, that two MPs had been suspended from the Liberal caucus. Is it possible to describe or discuss how people are feeling about, you know, that situation, I guess, in particular with everything that has transpired over the last few weeks?
I'd say everybody is really on edge. But when I say on edge, I wonder what people will think when I say that word. It's just, we've gone through so much this fall. I would argue that we are still processing a lot of emotions around the shooting that happened in October. I would argue that we're all still pretty delicate from that. And then these harassment allegations, first of all, not just that they happened, but the way in which they were made public, how we are actually learning a lot about what is going on or what is allegedly going on via the media. I feel when I talk to some of my colleagues that they feel very powerless. They don't know how to help. They don't know what to say or what we're supposed to do. And then you read another little tidbit of information about X or Y that might have happened in the papers. So it's been really challenging. I actually see some of my colleagues having some shorter fuses or getting angry about stuff that they wouldn't normally. And I would make the links to what's happening around this issue of harassment on the Hill. I think that people feel really powerless and they don't know how to navigate this.
Beyond those two accusations and the two situations with the two Liberal MPs and the two NDP MPs, there became, I guess, this larger discussion around how people treated each other on the Hill, sexual harassment, how women felt on the Hill, both MPs and staff. You know, lots of people wrote sort of about their own experiences, about the experiences of others. Where would you say that discussion is at right now?
Well, when I've been reading these stories, I think it's been really positive. I'm a young woman on the Hill who, particularly in my early days as a quote-unquote rookie MP, had a real culture shock coming to the Hill. And I've written about that too and spoken publicly about that. And it's opened up the ability to talk about it and have it sort of be legitimized because other people are talking about it too, that's been really positive. And it's created conversations in the hallways or conversations, you know, informally with whether it's staff or journalists or fellow MPs. Those conversations have been really positive. Where is it at now? I actually feel like that conversation has been quieted. And I think it's been quieted, silenced, in part because of what's going on around the allegations with the two Liberal male MPs and the two NDP women. I think that we're in a situation now where people are looking for salacious details, they're looking for the big reveal, they're looking for these really dramatic stories. And because of that, I think it's actually silencing some of the good discussion that we have been having about culture generally on the Hill. I think that people are a little shy about continuing that culture conversation, maybe because it's not, pardon this word, sexy enough, because the way that the story is playing out around the harassment allegations is somehow impacting how we want to talk about the culture on the Hill. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's something I'm sort of working through these days. Like, why isn't anybody talking about this culture question anymore?
What would you say to young women at this point who are considering either being an MP or working as political staff on Parliament Hill? Like, given everything that has been out there in the past month, would you still say to women, you know, this is a good place to be, this is, you know, where your country, you know, needs you to be?
Absolutely. And I realize how strange that sounds coming out of my mouth when I hear it out loud. But we need more women in politics. We do. And there's an incredible network of strong women here, and you will come to rely on them and lean on them and take strength from them, and we need to be here. That's not to say that it might not be a great shock, depending on the kind of workplace environment you came from. But, you know, I actually met with one of our candidates for the next election. She just happened to be in Ottawa, and so I had coffee with her this week, and she's watching it all. You know, she's watching it on the news at night. She's reading about it in the paper. And it hasn't fazed her. You know, she still wants to run. She still wants to be a part of what it is that we're doing, because we're doing incredible work. We're doing important, important work. And she recognizes that while the culture on Parliament Hill may be different and may not have changed much in the past couple of months, certainly the reporting frenzy around it is an unusual situation, that it's not quite always this tough. I mean, I'm doing this interview with you, and I'm happy to, but I've spent the past 3 weeks doing interviews exclusively on harassment. That's not actually why I ran. It's an important, important thing for me to be talking about right now, and I'm honored to be able to do it, but there are other things that we are working on, that we should be working on. It's just a really crappy set of circumstances right now.
That was NDP MP Megan Leslie speaking about the misconduct allegations on the Hill.
The Supreme Court has a new justice joining the bench. Prime Minister Stephen Harper has announced that Suzanne Côté, an experienced Quebec trial lawyer, will be taking over the spot of Justice Louis Lebel, who begins his retirement on Monday. Côté has been a member of the Quebec Bar since 1981 and is the first woman from private practice to be directly appointed to the Supreme Court. Days before, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Beverly McLaughlin, actually gave a speech at Ottawa City Hall and candidly said she was hoping for another woman on the bench. She makes her point by slipping into a Scottish brogue and quoting Bertha Wilson, the first woman to sit on the court.
She leaned over and whispered to me at the ceremony. She says, 3 down, 6 to go. that may have scandalized some of the men. But we're still at three. We got up to four for a while, and we'll have a new appointment coming soon. So who knows? We may get back up to four. We may not. But I as a woman, find the presence of at least a third of the court being women to be a very good thing. It changes the atmosphere. Gender politics don't play a role once you get beyond a certain number.
This is the second Supreme Court appointment in a row where there was no input from members of Parliament. The Prime Minister seems to have dropped the MP advisory panel used before an appointment and has scrapped the committee process afterwards to question the nominee. This started after the failed attempt to appoint Federal Court Judge Mark Nadal to the top court. His nomination was later rejected by the Supreme Court itself. Maybe no politician understands the inner workings of the appointment process better than Liberal MP Erwin Cotler. Back in 2004, as Justice Minister in the former Liberal government, Cotler brought in key reforms to how Supreme Court judges are chosen. He speaks with McLean's Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Mr. Cotler, thanks for talking to us about this. If I could ask a devil's advocate question out of the gate. We had what has been pretty much universally heralded as a good choice for a new Supreme Court justice this week. Why do we need a different process? Why is the kind of behind closed doors, rather secretive process that went into this choice, why do we have to worry about it if we're getting good judges?
It's interesting enough that the Harper government itself, when it was in opposition and running for office, made issues of transparency and openness and accountability benchmarks of what they thought were good governance, which would hold also, I would think, for the Supreme Court appointment process. But apart from the benchmarks, if you have a process, as they've had for the last two Supreme Court appointments, which is closed and unrepresentative and unaccountable, with no advisory selection panel, with no participation by Parliament and the public, this ends up, however inadvertently, breeding disrespect for the judiciary, for Parliament, even for the public. The public should be able to be knowledgeable of the process, should be able to engage in the process. When I was Minister of Justice, we even invited the public to make their own recommendations as to nominees for the Supreme Court. And we certainly involved Parliament, and we certainly involved bench, bar, and academe, and we were open about it. We published a protocol as to
this was the 2004 reforms.
2004 and 2005, again, when prospectively for Justice Marshall Rothstein, we concluded the process. We were then defeated as a government. Vic Taves, the incoming justice minister with whom I spoke, and said, Vic, you were part of this process. We unanimously recommended Rothstein and said, absolutely, said we will nominate him.
Hmm. Obviously, the government was wounded by the messy process surrounding the attempt to appoint Justice Nadal to the Supreme Court. They felt that the fact that their shortlist was leaked was enough reason to say this process couldn't be followed, at least this time and the time before. What do you think about that? Isn't this kind of a version of bad cases making bad law, unfortunate episode?
That was a self-inflicted wound.
Yes.
In effect, Nadal was, and I don't speak as to his merits, but Nadal was ineligible, and they were alerted to that. They still went ahead with it, and then it ended up having to ensue with a Supreme Court determination that, in fact, he was ineligible. All that could have been avoided had they taken the advice of what a consultative process would have given them to begin with. So, in effect, the Supreme Court appointment process, by being as it was, invited that kind of situation. With regard to the confidentiality, we've always had the media speculating about candidates. There's nothing wrong with that. I introduced
I think I may have been guilty of doing that myself on occasion.
Well, I mean, this happens all the time. For all of a sudden, the government to seize on the fact that there was reference to prospective candidates and A, ascribe it to a leak, and B, if there had been a leak, it might have come from government sources and been another self-inflicted wound in that regard. But, you can't use that to shut down the whole process. In fact, when I was minister, I introduced the confidentiality protocol. If that had been breached, I wouldn't have said, okay, that's been breached, therefore we're not going to have, a process at all. Yeah. I think that's what we're seeing now.
What would be the sort of rudimentary elements of a good process? What do we need to have it be both enough confidentiality that people involved in it can speak freely, but enough openness that the public can feel like they understand the process.
Okay. Number one, publish a protocol of the people to be consulted, and therefore we'd have a public understanding of who's being consulted. Two, publish the evaluation criteria so that, again, the public would know how we assess prospective candidates. Three, the Minister of Justice, after undertaking the consultation, would then refer a prospective list of 6 to 8 candidates to a then independently established Supreme Court advisory panel for their own independent consultation and evaluation. Hmm. Then that group, having undertaken their own independent consultation, and all this is what we did back in 2004-2005, would then give a short list back to the Minister of Justice, would then reconsult throughout this process. Parliament would be involved, the bench, bar, academe, and the like. And then finally, the Minister of Justice would appear before a parliamentary committee to answer questions as to how the nominee was chosen, as to how this process in fact developed and was undertaken, as to how the criteria were used to determine the nominee and the like. So that way you would have an open, transparent, inclusive, representative, accountable process in which Parliament, the public, bench, bar, all would be engaged.
Mr. Kotler, thanks a lot for talking to us about this. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. Good speaking with you.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Liberal MP Erwin Kotler.
Still to come on the show, U.S. Senator John McCain joins us to discuss Iraq, Iran, and Ukraine, and the McLean's panel weighs in on First Nations financial transparency and the problems around funding at Veterans Affairs. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine. Last week, some of the top defense officials in the world gathered in Halifax for the International Security Forum. One of the key figures to attend was U.S. Senator John McCain, who lost to Barack Obama in the 2008 presidential election. The Arizona Republican stopped to speak with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, about what he sees as the messes in Iraq, Iran, and Ukraine.
Let's sort of take them one by one. Start with Iran.
This administration is desperate for some kind of foreign policy success. And by the way, they're ignoring Iranian behavior in Yemen, where they've destabilized that country, their involvement with Hezbollah and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard in Syria, their incursions in other parts of the Middle East. They're an enemy, and they're on the move, and they're having some success.
So I take it then that you would also not look kindly on the notion that we should sort of conscript Iran into the fight against ISIS.
I think that Iran may be of some assistance against the fight against ISIS, but it would be a immoral alliance that these Iranians are responsible for the deaths of 200,000 Syrians, 3.5 million refugees. They have, of course, been incredibly brutal in their own country. They have exported terror throughout the region. And somehow to get in bed with them, to me, would be a fundamental contradiction to everything we stand for and believe in.
So instead of working with the Iranians against ISIS, instead of striking an easy bargain with them on nuclear arms, what should the U.S. administration be doing? What should administration do, for instance?
We should be making sure they understand that we will form alliances, that we will act with our allies, who, by the way, no longer trust us after the Syrian red line debacle. And we should be supplying arms and equipment to the Free Syrian Army. We should establish a no-fly zone in Syria rather than have these people butchered by these barrel bombs.
A similar prescription in Ukraine. You would have the Americans arm the Ukrainian opposite, or arm the Ukrainian government so that it can fend off these incursions in the east.
You know, what's just been mind-boggling to me, and when I tell my constituents that we are not even providing the Ukrainians with defensive weapons as Vladimir Putin dismembers the country, they don't believe it. They don't believe that we wouldn't supply weapons, not send the Marines, not send the military, but just give them weapons with which to defend themselves. They're astounded. The latest, by according to our NATO commander, General Breedlove, is that he's moved several thousand into southeastern Ukraine. We all knew, and I predicted, he wants a land bridge to Crimea. Now he's going to figure out whether he can get away with moving all the way over to Moldova. He's already putting intense pressure on the Baltic countries. He's trying to restore the old Russian Empire. And that doesn't mean we get into a war with Russia. But at least it means that we should give them arms to defend themselves. Ukrainians lost over 4,000 brave young men already.
Surely Putin would treat arming the Ukrainians as an act of war by NATO.
After he has invaded the country and we are worried about how he views us giving weapons to them? Did Brezhnev view it as an act of war when we provided arms to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan? I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. Are we somehow think that Vladimir Putin, who when asked about Russian troops in Crimea, said, oh, they can buy uniforms at local stores? This is a person who we should worry about how he views us assisting people who are struggling for freedom. This really shows, is really a glaring example of the fundamental misconception that this President Obama has about Russia and the world.
I want to take you right back around the circle to ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and the multilateral airstrike campaign in which Canada is participating quite heavily. There's a six-month deadline, there's a six-month window for the Canadian intervention before it's reevaluated by Parliament. What do you make of that timescale?
I respect whatever the Canadian Parliament decides, but if they think that this kind of air power is going to have any decisive effect on the battlefield, that they don't understand warfare. Look, we are pinpricked as targets. Remember those wonderful pictures we saw, those buildings being hit? Most of them were empty because we gave them a couple of weeks' warning. So what the present strategy, well, first of all, there is no strategy. Second of all, the actions that are being taken will not succeed. And we're going to, I predict to you, we will have to do more. Unfortunately, the president will be pulled into it rather than devising an overall strategy and doing whatever is necessary to achieve the goal that he has stated, which is to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIS. Under the present conditions on the battlefield, that'll never happen.
So, Iran, Syria, Ukraine, and the sort of nebulous fight against ISIS, in each case you've called for a higher level of American and Western engagement. You know the rap against John McCain by your political opponents. He's never had a fight that he didn't like. He's never seen a fight that he didn't like. Doesn't this begin to look like that? We just named four theaters where you want to ramp up American and Western involvement.
Well, first of all, it didn't have to happen. If we'd left a residual force behind, which we could have, that's the view of Secretary Gates, Secretary Panetta, and Ryan Crocker. So this didn't have to happen the way it is. This is the same ISIS that, was it a year ago, that the president said was the JV? This is a feckless, unfocused foreign policy for which we are paying a very, very heavy price, and it'll be all over the world as well. There's a perception of American weakness. Now, how do I say that with confidence? Because I meet with these leaders, and they tell me that. And so all I can say is we're in for some very rough couple of years.
That was McLean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with U.S. Senator John McCain.
It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, joined as always by my co-host Aaron Weary and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining us, guys. All right, we're going to start off with the financial transparency for First Nations. The deadline was this week for them to come forward with all of their books and their spending and how they're using taxpayers' cash that comes to them from the federal government. The government brought this forward, saying we need to look into the books and see how the money is spent. Well, that's happened. And John, McLean's has been doing a lot of crunching of the numbers. What have we found out after you've looked at all of the books?
Sure, Cormac. The interesting thing here is that These numbers have been rolling in over time, and there was a little flurry of last-minute ones coming in this week. But the interesting thing is they're coming in on individual PDF documents, so there's no database for the public to look at or anything like that. So what we've been doing on claims is as they come in, we've been keeping our own spreadsheets so we keep an idea of what's happening. Some of those numbers are still being crunched even today for us, but what we know so far is that the median income for a chief and the bands that have had to, about 500 of the bands we've been able to look at so far who filed documents, the median income, sort of the midpoint between the lowest and highest, is in the low 60s, low 60,000 range. That's untaxed income on reserves, so it equates to about 80,000 for somebody who's making a taxable income. It's not a low figure, but I don't think it's the kind of figure that's going to pop out as an outrageous figure either. So part of the story here is that for the normal average First Nation in Canada, the chiefs and band councillors don't seem to be making an outrageous amount. Now, there are some who are making outrageous amounts, and of course, a lot of the focus will go to them. About 50 chiefs make base salaries of more than $100,000. About 150, a bit more than that, if you include their expenses and other income they make from the band, make more than $100,000. I would say that in those cases, the communities involved are going to want to look hard themselves at what they're paying their elected political leaders. There's a fair amount of number crunching and fine-tuning to go before people really understand the data. The good news, I would say, for the federal government is that they're going to be able to point at, I would say, probably dozens of bands where people are going to raise their eyebrows about how much money is flowing to the elected chiefs and councillors. The good news for the First Nations who have been pushing back against this is the average band, the sort of norm in Canada, does not look outrageous.
Some of them have not actually submitted their books yet to the federal government. What are the repercussions for those who have not?
To be honest, Cormac, it's surprisingly few. If you had asked when this whole process started how many bands will balk at doing this, I think people would have predicted a fairly high percentage. Actually, more than 90% of bands have decided to file the paperwork. Some are actively protesting this whole thing, and prominent among those is the Onion Lake Band, which sort of straddles the Alberta-Saskatchewan border. They've launched a lawsuit saying this whole thing is illegitimate and they shouldn't have to say how much they are paying people. The repercussions that Bernard Valcourt, the Aboriginal Affairs Minister, has talked about is twofold. One is cutting off what he calls non-essential funding. So he says immediately, or it's not clear how immediately, could be next week, he's going to cut off transfers of money that's earmarked for band administration. That's the money that a First Nation would typically draw on to pay its councillors. That means he would keep transferring money for things like education and health and possibly even basic infrastructure. The other possible repercussion is interesting. It would be the government going to court to seek court orders ordering bands to comply. And that could get quite messy because when you go into court and you're talking about First Nations, a lot of things about Aboriginal rights come into play. The feds are going to want to be very careful before they ask a judge to consider all these questions.
All right, so we're going to switch now to the issue of veterans and mental health services. The Auditor General brought out his report this week, found that there wasn't timely access for a lot of veterans to get mental health services. Then we found out the $200 million to mental health services that came out on the weekend just before this report. We found out later on in the week this is for the life cycle of the program, not the initial 6 years as many people in the media were led to believe. So, first of all, Aaron, what do you think about this whole fiasco about mental health services with the veterans and all the news that's happened this week?
It seems to be a sort of a series of unfortunate events for the government. If one of these things had happened kind of on its own, maybe they don't have as big a problem. But they close some veterans' offices and move them into Service Canada offices, and that creates outcry. You know, Julian Fantino has that disastrous on-camera meeting with veterans. This AG report comes out. The news this, I guess today, that the investment is over 50 years and not over 6 years, is a minor story most other times if it's not coming after all of these things. It's amazingly how bad this has all gone for the government, and I don't know where the sort of crux of the problem becomes, but they just seem to be constantly finding new problems. The closure of the veterans' offices, I think, is an interesting part of this because we've had this kind of vague discussion about budget and how budget cuts are being implemented, and this has become the one thing that people have been able to grab onto and say, well, there's a budget cut that we don't like. And that has become, I think, sort of the springboard for all of this. I don't think they're served particularly well by not having the minister in the the House. I don't think that helps. But at the same time, I don't know whether having Fantino in the House would have helped. Anyway, the man is not...
Fiasco is the word that Cormac used to set this whole thing up.
I don't know whether a different minister would have helped them. I don't know whether they've just gotten themselves into a problem that they just can't get themselves out of now. They've put so much emphasis on supporting the troops and on the military, and now they have been found lacking in certain areas, and it just hurts that much.
And just before we go, we're going to switch gears here to an event that happened this week, on Wednesday night. Justin Trudeau, Liberal leader, was in town with the governor of Maryland, and they were talking about data-driven policy initiatives. Aaron, you were following this. What exactly happened? Because it wasn't really covered that well on Parliament.
No, I think it's maybe the most interesting thing that happened all week, or it could be at least. The governor of Maryland comes up for a Canada 2020 event. He is potentially going to run for president in 2016, so it's kind of viewed as a showcase for him. But at the end of his speech, he's up on stage with Justin Trudeau for a Q&A. And what Martin O'Malley is most famous for in the United States is taking a data-driven approach to policy. He was mayor of Baltimore, and he came in and said, we're going to look at the numbers. We're going to look at them openly. We're going to set targets. We're going to, you know, use graphs and charts and maps, and we're really going to use sort of, essentially data-driven policy as our hallmark. And he then took that to the state level as governor of Maryland. And Trudeau, in his questions, goes right to that, right off the top, and says, tell us more about this data-driven policy. You know, what are you doing? How are you doing it? Can we scale it to a federal level? It's a bit arcane, and it can sound a bit policy wonkish, but, making decisions on policy based on what the data tells you, based on what the results of policies are, is sort of a revolutionary approach to policy. As people have pointed out, a lot of times the discussion is about, well, we put $200 million into this, we put $1 billion into this. It's not, we put $200 million in and we got X. It's all about how much goes in. It's not about what comes out. And Trudeau seems interested in this. I asked his office afterwards, you know, is this something he's interested in? They said, oh, yes, it has, you know, it has ramifications. If Trudeau really wants to go forward with this, and if he's really committed to it, and if he really wants to make this a hallmark of his platform, it could be very interesting. First, because it would change the way policy is done, in theory. Politically, it's a whole new open process of dealing with policy. It exposes politicians to actually having to prove that they're getting results for the things they're doing. And I think also in a certain way, for Trudeau, who has been criticized for A, not having enough policy, and B, being a bit of a policy lightweight, it adds a bit of seriousness to him. And it comes along at sort of this perfect moment, because we just had Joe Oliver in front of a finance committee, asked about an EI hiring credit that's going to cost $550 million, and his response is, well, the Canadian Federation of Independent Business says it's going to be good, so we're on track here. You know, it's a perfect moment to have this discussion about, okay, so what exactly are we doing with all of these tax credits and all of these policies that we're doing? What exactly are we getting out of it?
Thanks very much, co-host Aaron Wary, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.